Welcome back to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. I'm joined in the studio with co-host Dr. Robert Schmidt, director of Tayu Meditation Center in Sebastopol, and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol. We are enjoying a beautiful autumn afternoon in West Sonoma County in our studio in Occidental, and talking about a number of topics. In the first hour of the show, we were talking about the art of possibility. And now I think Rob is going to turn the conversation to a different topic.
Well, I'll just say that obviously in the first hour you were talking about some of the stuff you've been reading and how that integrates or doesn't integrate with your own thought and experience. And so I've had the same process going, of course, as a reader since the age of seven or whatever. I certainly have a lot of experience now, more than half a century of experience in reading and letting things settle within me and observing that process. And there have been a couple of books that have been particularly... have particularly impressed me lately, and both are books for written by people that we're going to be interviewing on this show. One was the book Before the Sun that I think we mentioned earlier by John Mann, student of Swami Rudrananda, wonderfully original American spiritual teacher in the 50s and 60s, and died in 73, I believe. And then another book for our interview subject, by our interview subject for next week, Linda Mercadante, who is a professor, I think, of theology at a university in Ohio. This is her book, Belief Beyond Borders. And she's examining in that book the phenomenon of those people who describe themselves as spiritual but not religious. Spiritual but not religious. S-B-N-Rs is the acronym.
S-B-N-Rs.
S-B-N-Rs. Actually, I guess that can roll trippingly off
yes.
the tongue.
S-B-N-Rs.
S-B-N-Rs. So these S-B-N-Rs, the phenomenon of S-B-N-Rs, is one that she is interested in exploring. She does... I'm not going to talk too much about the book because we'll certainly be getting into that next week with the author herself. And I also, however, have been reflecting on one of the salient points that has arisen for me in the book. I don't think it's necessarily something that she would... the author would necessarily point to as something important, but to get there, I need to just explain briefly that the book is the product of the author's series of interviews that she did with lots of different people from different backgrounds, all of whom have in common this SBNR identity, if you will. Something that that she's interested in exploring, and it's an inherently interesting phenomenon. Certainly, my years now in working at Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol has made me extremely familiar with this sort of phenomenon, and one of the things that struck me about the book is her treatment of people who profess that they are SBNR, spiritual but not religious, and how that varies according to age, or as she would put it, in age cohorts. So, for example, she starts talking about people from the greatest generation, from 1900, born in 1900 to 1926. Then it's the silent generation, which would be the generation of my parents, from 26 to, I think, 45 or 44. And then the baby boomers.
So my parents are the greatest generation, and yours are the silent generation.
That's right. That's right.
Interesting.
Well, I'm not sure that your year was your mother
25.
Born? 25. So she just makes the cut there. So that's right. Yeah, my father was born in 28, and my mother in 1930. So anyway, and I'm older than you.
Yeah.
So of course you're the baby from the family. And I'm the oldest. In any event, she's looking at these, and of course I forgot to mention, then there's so-called Gen Xers and Millennials. One of the things that was notable to me, not necessarily notable in particular, but notable to me because of my personal experience is the observation that as you start to look at people born more and more recently, more and more likely are they to, at least if she's looking at a particular group of people with this SBNR orientation or identification, you're more and more likely to find people who did not grow up in a religious context in the sort of way that I did.
What do you mean, a completely non-religious context where their parents just didn't go to church at all, or a sort of, like, I grew up in a religious context that wasn't overly prominent in my life. You know, we were Episcopalians and went to church, but by the time I was 12, I think we even stopped going regularly except for holidays.
Mm-hmm.
So is that different? Are you talking about completely?
I'm not talking about any particular extreme. I'm talking about a direction.
Okay.
And so you know, if this if people associated with this SBNR phenomenon, and these are self-identified people. These are people who resonate with this SBNR. It's not a designation applied by someone else. These are people who are happy to articulate and in fact are willing to talk. She spoke between 1 and 2 hours with most of these people in these interviews that she did, and some of them would have talked more. And on multiple occasions. So, but this feature of an increasing, I don't know if the word irreligiosity is the right word, an increasingly less identified with religion as they are growing up, basically, that is, in other words, with their formative years, and then there were some examples in the book of people who grew up with no particular religious background. The author, by the way, and I'm sure we'll get into this next week with her, starts off the book with an introduction where she describes being raised as a nun, N-O-N-E, not a nun, N-U-N, but not basically none of the above. In other words, that was a precursor term, if you will, for SBNR, someone who didn't have a religious affiliation. And so she's looking at how religious affiliation is for people who have this SBNR identity, if you will, they increasingly tend to come over time from a non-religious background. It's hard to say whether that whether there's any correlation or not, because she's not looking at the entirety of the American population. But it certainly does seem to me that there's a trend for increasing. Lower. I mean, she does mention, of course, in some considerable detail about the overall trend of lack of religious affiliation growing over time.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to add into this discussion, that it's an interesting area because it certainly represents a growing demographic socially, but spiritual but not religious immediately calls out for an interesting inquiry into, well, what do you mean by spiritual, and what do you mean by religious, and how do we distinguish those?
Well, I'll just jump in real quick and say the first question is open. The second question, what do you mean by religious, is basically defined by affiliation with an established religious group.
Okay. And would, if someone is, let's say, Wiccan, would that be considered religious?
I think she would consider that to be religious, although it's actually a good question. I don't think she's really, I think, examining the phenomenon. She's from she's a faculty member at a some kind of a Protestant denomination university, I believe. And so I think she's looking at the disaffiliation from Christianity.
Right.
Mostly. She also is looking at the phenomenon. I mean, she talks to people who disaffiliate from a Buddhist heritage, you know, if they're like have a heritage from Asia or something like
so,
that.
So the interesting question is, would someone who, an American raised as a Protestant who, or as a Jew who becomes a Buddhist, like a Zen Buddhist, would that be considered religious, or would that be considered spiritual?
I think in the way she's looking at it, that probably, I mean, she would acknowledge the religious affiliation with Zen, for example. I think a Zen sect. And nevertheless, she would also point to the fact that there's been a disaffiliation, and it's possible that, and one of the things, one of the ways that people, even and I've seen this here in Sonoma County, very frequently, a lot of people who describe themselves as Buddhist would also describe themselves as spiritual but not religious.
Right, and that's the partly. What I'm getting at is, what does that terminology really, is that code for people who aren't really, who have been raised in either by their parents or their parents' parents in a Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, or maybe even Islamic denomination and have fallen away from that? Is that really where the main focus of this phenomenon is, as opposed to people who, having fallen away from those traditions, become Vipassana practitioners or Zen Buddhists or Tibetan Buddhists?
So I guess you're asking, is the phenomenon of disaffiliation, whether by one's parents or grandparents or further, or oneself, is that the phenomenon under investigation?
Right.
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, kind of. That people hold they acknowledge that they're not materialists, they're not new atheists or logical positivists, in that they admit the possibility of a spiritual dimension to life, but they no longer have any identification with the traditional religious forms.
Well, I think most of the people she interviews, I mean, she doesn't exclude people who would identify as Buddhism at all, or Wiccan, to get to your earlier question, at least as I understand it. But it's this the identification with a sort of freedom, which is, I think, where people are locating the spiritual part of things,
mm-hmm.
And then it's a freedom from a religious affiliation that was seen to be constraining freedom. So I think that she would, I don't know if she would, what she would say to this, but what's coming up for me is that I think she's seeing that the question of religious affiliation is the issue of whether someone feels constrained or not constrained.
Okay.
In terms of affiliation, and this, and the word spiritual thus gets glossed as something which does not dismiss the possibilities for philosophical and other explorations outside of a kind of narrow materialist viewpoint, but it's the exploration happens outside whatever traditional constraints our society previously would seem to have opposed, even though we had this pluralist society. Nevertheless, pluralist, as she points out in one part of the book, in the 50s, you know, religious affiliation was extraordinarily high in America, higher than it had been previously.
Right. Wait, during which period?
The 1950s. That was a peak.
So I wanted to add a kind of a different dimension to this discussion, because it goes a little bit off of the subject of SBNRs, but it's related in that very recently, I think this month, Sam Harris just released his new book, which I think will probably be one of his most important books, called Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion.
Right.
And it's related in the sense that, you know, Sam Harris is normally kind of classed as one of the new atheists, like with Richard Dawkins, although I've always felt that he was in a very different category, because he actually acknowledged the objective experiences of meditation, and he acknowledges the objective phenomenology of spiritual inquiry and some of the spiritual psychology that I'm certainly familiar with from the Fourth Way, but he is decidedly not religious and doesn't sort of rejects out of hand the revealed word of religions, but is very interested in the spiritual techniques and technology that evolved within religious contexts. And you know, what's interesting to me is that
I'm not sure I completely agree with that last statement, although I understand why you phrased it the way you did. I think his project, as I understand it, with that book, is to actually strip away much of what evolved in these traditions.
Well, he wants to, as he puts it, he wants to strip away the religious or the Baroque religiosity from some spiritual practices that actually have objective, results.
Right, and his framing of it is that religions are may carry some of these techniques that are quote objectively useful unquote, but that they would be even more useful if they were not encased within the Baroque religiosity, yeah. To use that phrase.
So I'll just read the quick blurb on this, on Waking Up. It says, for the millions of Americans who want spirituality without religion, Sam Harris's new book is a guide to meditation as a rational spiritual practice informed by neuroscience and psychology. From multiple New York Times best-selling author, neuroscientist, and quote-unquote new atheist Sam Harris, Waking Up is for the 30% of Americans who follow no religion, but who suspect that Jesus, Buddha, Lao Tzu, Rumi, and the other saints and sages of history could not have all been epileptics, schizophrenics, or frauds. Throughout the book, Harris argues that there are important truths to be found in the experiences of such contemplatives, and therefore that there is more to understanding reality than science and secular culture generally allow. Waking Up is part seeker's memoir and part exploration of the scientific underpinnings of spirituality. No other book marries contemplative wisdom and modern science in this way, and no author other than Sam Harris, a scientist, philosopher, and famous skeptic, could write it. So we'll be reading this and reviewing this book on a later program. I think it is a very relevant to the thesis of this show, and so it'll be interesting to see the degree to which we are in alignment or disagree with some of the takes of Harris. But it's interesting to me because in the same way that we have an emerging group of people who want to be spiritual but not religious, when a book like this comes out, it almost seems to be an answer to that call. Maybe. And that's
I'm not sure what you mean by an answer to this call.
Well, for people yearning for a deeper connection to their lives or the truth of their being, but who don't find that really reflected in the kind of the social framework of mainstream religions today, a book like this offers a guidance that there are ways to connect with a spiritual truth about oneself without the need to sign on to a religious framework.
Got it. One of the things, when I just happened to write a brief email to someone I know who's I don't think he's affiliated anymore with the unorthodox Christian church, but has a background in Eastern Orthodox religions and or religion, I should say, and the response by this friend was that it's very dangerous, that's not a direct quote, but very dangerous to try to abstract out of a thousands of year old tradition specific practices and know what the effects are going to be for individuals who do certain practices.
Right. And that's an interesting response. And yet, I'm almost certain that Harris would say, well, that's a nice story, but that, you know, that sort of puts a level of a kind of a mystic layer on some of these practices that suggests that they, you know, I guess it's a self-serving kind of statement as well, that you would expect someone who's identified with a religious tradition to assert, because it's almost like saying, well, don't mess with this because you couldn't possibly get the whole picture because your project is fundamentally flawed. And I don't think that will be a compelling argument to Harris, even if there's...
Well, it wouldn't be a compelling argument, but neither is it. It works both ways.
Yeah.
Because Harris is starting off from the assumption, and I think this is more what this person was trying to get at, Harris is starting off with the assumption and even the assertion that what he's calling Baroque religiosity must actually be not just useless, but actually obfuscation.
Right.
And be an obstacle to the kind of self-examination and self-inquiry that he seems to wish to promote, and when I look at it, I am persuaded by neither side fully, while also wanting to reserve the possibility that some of the aims of the religious contexts may have uses beyond what beyond the ones that Harris is likely to grant.
Right.
So, for example, what if there's a practice from Christianity called the Jesus Prayer, which is sort of like a mantra, and is used kind of like a mantra would be used, as right. I understand it. But I don't think it's fair if you don't have any regard for a or you don't hold the possibility of a divinity that would have some of the features of the Christian or of Jesus, of the ideas about Jesus in the Christian religion, will using that technique have the same effect?
Oh, yeah, that's actually a really good example. I mean, I think that if I put myself in Harris's place, he would certainly acknowledge that the objective effects of that practice in part depend on the practitioner putting themselves in an appropriate frame such that they're open to an emotional experience that may not be possible if you're not in that frame. I mean, but I suspect he would argue that it's measurable, and he would probably not exclude the possibility that one can encounter and cultivate a sense of awe and a sense of wonder and a sense of profound humility through other analogous contemplations. So I think my sense is that he might both acknowledge the phenomenology of what the practitioner experiences and argue from a neuroscience point of view that it's measurable, and would argue that there's other ways to attain to the same state, that there's not something absolute in the magic of Jesus in doing the prayer, but that the person and the framework that they're bringing to the prayer produces a state of humility that allows one to let go of some of the constraints of this of the ordinary psychological mind and open oneself to a different kind of experience.
Got that? You got something against Jesus? You don't think he's got mojo?
Well, I'm as I said, I'm trying to put myself in the frame of what that argument is. I'm not necessarily claiming one thing or the other. But another example that came up to me that's we've had a number of people on our show. I'm thinking of Luis Monero, who wrote the book,
it's about out-of-body experiences.
Yeah, it's out-of-body experience.
I can't remember the exact title.
Yeah, I can't remember now. It's not Journeys Out of the Body. That was Robert Monero. He had a big, thick book, and he's part of an organization that has even thicker books on the phenomenology, the consistent phenomenology that a number of people report associated with these out-of-body experiences. And then we had another guest, Kevin Turner, on the show, who's a shamanic practitioner in the Michael Harner organization, and he is a teacher in that tradition, but he got into that path partly because as a young man, as a boy, he was having spontaneous out-of-body experiences. And he can speak to consistent phenomenology. When you get to that level of people who are describing phenomenology that have cosmic...
By phenomenology, you mean phenomena?
Yeah, I mean, they're describing being conscious outside of their body, having energetic bodies of different vibration rates, encountering realms of beings and consciousness that are populated with beings and entities, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole cosmology that's laid out there that is completely not addressed or accessible in what I take to be Harris's project. Harris's project is sort of fine for, if you look at basic meditation, certain spiritual practices like Zen doesn't really emphasize those kinds of experiences. It's very focused on the problem of suffering in the world. And I think that spirituality without religion in the Harris sense will get you there, but if there's an objective nature to our being outside of the context of our physical bodies and our consciousness, I don't see his approach being able to even touch that.
Yeah, well, it's Harris's project is a reductive project. In other words, I'm thinking of an analogy of Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, is famous for having gone through both the Bible and I've forgotten the name of the Muslim holy book,
the Quran.
Both the Bible and the Quran, and basically abstracting the parts that he thought were valid or real, or and dumping the rest as Baroque religiosity, essentially. And it's a similar kind of project, but we can, you know, from the perspective of two centuries later or more, we can see that Thomas Jefferson, I mean, I don't think he tried to create the kind of phenomenon, social phenomenon, that Harris would seek to do. And nevertheless, people still read Thomas Jefferson. But I don't see any particularly strong effects, except that people feel free to create their own version of the Bible. I've met people like that in our store in Many Rivers, and similar sorts of projects, and that gets us back to the SBNR phenomenon, because essentially that's one of the ways that you could see or interpret that phenomenon.
Right, and I guess in the, because our own tradition is has focused more on the practical effects of being in a body and spiritual practice in terms of attention and presence, that a lot of the focus is more practical, and I think that where Harris can reduce, and extract some of these practices, there isn't really a contradiction between the reductionist approach and many of the approaches. Like, if you are doing Vipassana meditation, there are certain benefits that come out of that. The question, which I think gets to the question that you raised from the person you were describing the email conversation with, is, I would phrase the question differently. It's not that you don't know that you might be mucking with stuff you don't understand when you take a practice outside of its cultural context. I would say it's more that there may be elements of the practice that you can't access and you can't even, approach when you do that.
I think that's a fair statement. That's the bigger danger.
Yeah, and I don't even necessarily consider it a danger. It's just more like, okay, that's fine. What you're doing is fine for as far as that goes, but it ultimately may not be a complete way of approaching a larger sense of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that, in the end, if as long as his project isn't ultimately grounded in reductionism as a thesis, I don't see there's a problem. That's why I'm interested to read the book, to see whether I tend to think he doesn't do that, although I think a lot of his audience does do that.
We'll see. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I think he's a complicated guy, and there are aspects of his manifestation that might be inclined to do that a little bit.
Yeah, I think so.
So I mean, I'm just, he's complicated in the sense that, he in his first big book, he made much of his opposition to Islam. And in some ways, he's backpedaled that over the years, and in other ways, he's even exacerbated his opposition to the intellectual framework that he sees Islam as both promoting and being the product of. And you know, you can take that for what it is, but then it, then he gets into all these he's gotten into all these things about gun ownership and just stuff that seems totally
Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Right. I mean, it's just like self-defense and stuff, like personal self-defense stuff. It's all fine what it is, but what does it have to do with...
Well, it's reductive because it locates one's reality as the primary focus is one's embodied life, because he doesn't...
But it's even a narrow reduction of that.
Well, if all you are is a body, then defending the body is a natural, a reasonable, rational response to that.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Whereas, you know, a saint in a spiritual tradition often demonstrates profound altruism or fearlessness because they're operating from a place where they're not a body. They're a spirit who happens to be focused on a body.
They're a tool of
a greater intelligence.
Right.
But now Harris may consider that a form of insanity that's fueled by schizophrenic ideals about born of religion. I don't know, but it is within the scope of his framework. You know, his focus on defense and things like that is sort of understandable and practical, but it's not interesting in the sense that I think it's an incomplete model.
Well, it's not interesting to me for a lot of reasons, and to say I agree with you, it's an incomplete model, but it's also a paranoid model, and that's it has a tendency to go in that direction, and that to me is the link to some of the stuff about both Islam, but particularly in Christianity, but particularly Islam, about the effects of certain ideas. I think it's just an historical. Well, I don't want to get into that.
I think we're getting to the end of our time here, so
yeah. Yeah, I don't want to leave the energy there.
Yeah, well, no, we shouldn't, because I think that next week we'll have an opportunity to talk more about spiritual but not religious, and
exactly.
in the framework that Linda Mercadante speaks about it, and we will definitely reserve time to talk about waking up, because I think that it will be a fun discussion. Not sure we can ever get Sam Harris on the show, but we can always try.
We have tried.
But we have tried. But he's a very busy man. I think most of what he does now is, if it's not big media, it's like email interviews.
Got it.
So, anyway, well, you have been listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I have been having a free-ranging discussion on the art of possibility and spirituality without religion, anticipating some of our upcoming shows, and enjoying a beautiful autumn afternoon in Sonoma County.
A free-range afternoon.
So next,
is that a free-range cow?
Yeah, it's a free-range cow.
Got it.
Next week, The Mystical Positivist will feature a live conversation, as we said, with Linda Mercadante, author of Belief Without Borders. Linda Mercadante grew up in a Jewish Italian Catholic Jersey girl in Newark, New Jersey. Since her mixed-faith immigrant parents banned religion at home, Linda became an early spiritual but not religious seeker. After trying many spiritual alternatives, including a stint as an atheist, she eventually found a spiritual home and is now a theology professor and minister. Her research on SBNRs won the prestigious Henry Luce III Fellowship in Theology and was published by Oxford University Press as Belief Without Borders: Inside the Minds of the Spiritual but Not Religious. Among her other books is her memoir, Bloomfield Avenue, A Jewish Catholic Jersey Girl's Spiritual Odyssey. She also writes on the spirituality of addiction, recovery, in victims and sinners, spiritual roots of addiction and recovery, as well as on gender issues and film. Tune in for that show on Saturday, October 4th at 4 p.m. All right, upcoming on the spiritual calendar in Sonoma County, the Offering Presence Practice Group of the Tayu Meditation Center staff will be meeting on Tuesday, September 30th at 7:30 p.m. at Minnie Rivers Books and Tea, 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. Presence is attention to experience just as it is without judgment. Unclouded attention to experience is the birthright humans are fated to lose and then reclaim. Presence is both the attainment and the means to regain that birthright. Thus, as we practice to be present in human form, our engagement with presence is a relationship with an ongoing multidimensional process. Presence emerges in the relationship between innocence and knowledge, the knowledge before judgment, and knowledge that encompasses both innocence and judgments. Join us for an ongoing discussion of these issues and for engagement with exercises that explore the practical metaphysics of offering presence to all and everything, or to everything and nothing in every moment of existence. And then, on Thursday at Minnie Rivers, Gold and Azure, Russian Mystics, Visionaries, and Prophets of the 19th and 20th Centuries with John Suslov. That's Thursday, October 2nd at 7:30 p.m., Minnie Rivers Books and Tea, 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. Russia's great spiritual tradition of Eastern Christianity had a cataclysmic encounter with modernity in the form of the Revolution of 1917. This talk will examine certain key concepts unique to Russia's mystical philosophers, such as the doctrine of Beauty Sophia, the concept of God-manhood, and the role of freedom and creativity in the context of human and cosmic evolution. Refracted through our time and culture, these ideas shed new light on current spiritual, philosophical, and political issues and debates. Particular emphasis will be given to the thought of Vladimir Solovyov and the works of Dostoevsky, Berdyaev, Bulgakov, and many others. What? How would you say that? Bulgakov and many others rest primarily on his shoulders. John Suslov holds an M.A. in religion and philosophy from Dominican University, and as a former college instructor, he is interested in the revitalization of traditional religious forms of knowledge, culture, and aesthetics. To that end, he has been involved in a long-term cross-cultural project to reconstruct the symbolic language, concepts, and methods used by ancient societies and civilizations to encode their knowledge in the form of myth and initiatory text. Chaos Community Radio thanks our neighborhood hardware store, Occidental Hardware, for their support of community radio here in West County. From building materials to office supplies, Occidental Hardware, we got the stuff. Located at the corner of Hill Street and Bohemian Highway in downtown Occidental. You can reach them by phone at 707-874-3441. Find them on Google Plus or visit their Facebook page at facebook.com/OCCHDWE. And Cal's Community Radio thanks the law offices of Omar Figueroa for their support. Omar Figueroa is a constitutional and criminal defense lawyer specializing in cannabis, counterculture, and cybercrime defense. Omar Figueroa also offers complimentary consultation in pending criminal cases. The law offices are located at 7770 Healdsburg Avenue, Suite A in Sebastopol. Omar habla español. The website is www.omarfigueroa.com or call them at 707-829-0215. Once again, Cal's Community Radio is membership supported. So, all of our volunteers work here for the joy of making community radio available to one and all. And we want your help. So go to www.kows.fm to find out how you can contribute today. Thank you for joining us once again for The Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. Also, please send comments and feedback to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Join us again next Saturday. Coming up next from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rock and Record Hop, so stay tuned. Until then,
we'll be listening to track 14 on Mediterraneo, a CD by the ensemble L'Arpeggiata, directed by Cristina Plujar. This one is called Oriamu Pisulina. It's a canto greco-salentino, that is from the Greek area of southern Italy.
All right. Oh, you pronounce it so beautifully. See you next week.
You bet.